For millions of people in the developing world, one thing stands between them and school or a job, and that is a good pair of glasses. Eye care is often a luxury in areas where health services are scarce. So researchers and entrepreneurs are looking for breakthrough technologies to bring down the cost of glasses and eye exams. NPR's Larry Abramson reports that one idea starts with a smartphone.
While glasses may be hard to come by in some places, smartphones are becoming more and more common. So a group of researchers is trying to turn those phones into eye exam machines. David Shaffrin is with iNetra, an MIT spinoff company, developing a connection between eyes and cell phones.
And our goal really is to empower millions and millions around the world by bringing eye care to people's homes in a way that was never possible before.
iNetra has developed a $2 scope that healthcare workers can clip onto a smartphone. The patient stares through the eyepiece and follows colored lines that appear on the screen. Software installed on the phone translates your responses into a measurement of your refractive error. That's what an optometrist needs to make you a pair of glasses. Shaffrin says it's just a question of leveraging the power of the smartphone.
Well, the phone is actually doing everything. It's projecting the images, and it's also doing the calculations. That's where all the smarts are.
iNetra is testing these devices in clinics all over the world. The hope is that they will be accurate enough to change optometry, both in developing countries and maybe even in more affluent areas. But there is skepticism. The classic eye exam starts with an automated reading by an expensive machine, which iNetra aims to replace. Next, your doctor follows up with a series of questions. Which lens helps you see better, number one or number two? Kuldev Singh, a professor at Stanford University, says for the consumer to be happy, that second subjective test is crucial.
Science helps, but I don't think there's a substitute for actually checking to see if the patient is satisfied with the refraction that any automated device will find.
iNetra says relying on the automated exam can be just as accurate, and it makes the process cheaper and more accessible. But once you get your prescription, you still have to get glasses made. iNetra's developers envision a network of providers that would lead from prescription to eyewear. But in some places, patients are already building their own glasses. The Center for Vision in the Developing World is collaborating with Dow Corning on cheap glasses with lenses made of liquid silicone. Dow's James Stevenson says initially the glasses are equipped with a little pump that can adjust the shape of this liquid lens.
And the user basically looks through the glasses, they cover up one eye, and they literally turn the pump until the object comes into very clear vision.
The biggest downside with these glasses, initially called ad specs, is that they're pretty clunky looking. The developers are working on a sleeker, more stylish version. These are promising technologies, but those who work in the developing world caution that many patients don't know that they could see better, so they don't ask for help. And Stanford's Kuldev Singh says once you get a patient to come to a clinic, it's important to go beyond glasses.
Certainly, it's not a substitute for a complete exam that checks the eyes for potentially blinding diseases like glaucoma and macular degeneration.
At the same time, a little healthcare is better than none at all, especially when the ability to see well can mean so much to a child trying to see a blackboard in school. Larry Abramson, NPR News.
Support for All Tech Considered comes from Carbonite, providing automatic online backup to protect photos, music, and other computer files from loss. Details at carbonite.com.
This is NPR News.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Thursday morning, you're almost there. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Renee Montaigne. Facebook filed papers for an initial public offering last night, and this morning it's finding out how many friends it really has. Facebook's revenues are disappointing many analysts who had expected the company to be earning more from advertising than it actually is. NPR's Steve Henn has more.
With more than 840 million members and nearly half a billion people logging into Facebook every day, Deborah Aho Williamson was convinced Facebook had already become an advertising juggernaut.
We had been expecting Facebook to have total revenue of $4.27 billion in 2011.
And, you know, clearly they didn't meet that expectation.
Facebook fell almost $500 million short. Williamson's an analyst for eMarketer, a firm that tries to estimate the earnings of privately held tech startups like Facebook and Twitter. In this case, her estimates were too optimistic.
I am a little bit disappointed. It shows, I think, that Facebook still has a lot of growing to do as a company.
Williamson says to live up to the sky-high expectations among potential investors, Facebook may need to do a better job convincing big brands to spend money advertising on its site.
Most brands already have a Facebook page. And if you talk to most major companies, they 100% believe that Facebook is where they want to be to market to their consumers, to talk to them, to deliver coupons, to interact, to engage. But they oftentimes want to do it for free.
In his letter to potential investors, Mark Zuckerberg, Facebook's co-founder and CEO, said he didn't set out to build a business. Instead, he said Facebook began as a way to transform how we communicate and share with each other. And after Facebook's IPO, Zuckerberg will still be firmly in charge. He will control more than 50% of the voting stock, and Facebook won't be required to appoint an independent board of directors.
This issue of control and Mark Zuckerberg's stake is a two-edged sword.
Kathy Smith is at Renaissance Capital.
The downside is we'd like to see an independent board. The upside of his control is that this is his baby and there's nothing else that he has but Facebook.
Smith advises hedge funds and institutional investors about upcoming IPOs. She says Facebook will be expensive by any measure. Anant Sundaram agrees. He's a corporate valuation expert at Dartmouth's Tuck School of Business. He says if you look at Google and Facebook taken together and ask, what would they have to earn in the coming years to justify their current stock prices? The answer is remarkable.
These two companies would have to account for a humongous portion, something like 1/5 to 1/4 of the global advertising revenue base across all media, print, billboards, radio, television, internet. And that to me seems extremely aggressive.
Still, unlike some other internet companies that have gone public recently, Facebook is unambiguously profitable. It earned $1 billion in after-tax income last year. It has cash and marketable securities worth nearly $4 billion. Its IPO will raise $5 billion more. It's not about to go out of business. Still, analysts say that doesn't mean Facebook shares will be worth the price Wall Street bankers are likely to charge for them. Steve Henn, NPR News, Silicon Valley.
We're going to head now from the site of the Super Bowl to some of the world's biggest websites. Big changes are in store at Google and Facebook. Facebook is the world's largest social media site, and the company filed for its initial public offering, or IPO, yesterday. It is hoping to raise $5 billion through the sale of stock to the public. At the same time, Facebook is catching flack for its timeline format. The timeline takes all of your postings and photos, like that embarrassing picture from the kegger in 2006, and makes them easily available for you and other users to see. On the other hand, critics are raising concerns about changes to Google's privacy policy. The new policy lets Google share user information with its other services like YouTube, Gmail, and the Google search engine. Here to explain what all of this could mean for you is Cecilia Kang. She is a national technology reporter for The Washington Post, and she's with us from the newsroom there. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Could we just start with the news about Facebook? Why does this IPO, this initial public offering, this first sale of stock to the public, why is it creating so much excitement?
Well, it's creating so much excitement because everybody knows how dominant Facebook has become, how it's become sort of the social network of choice. I think it has about 90% of all users, social media users. 845 million users around the globe are using Facebook. So everybody knew that there's a lot of value in this company. So it became really sort of the most anticipated business event that people had been looking for quite some time.
Is there enough growth potential in Facebook to warrant this this price tag?
It's a great question. The thing about this stock offering is that, you know, Wall Street is unforgiving in some ways, and they want continued growth. And Facebook's growth is still on a trajectory, but it's slowing. And so Facebook, that's going to be a big question. How will Facebook make money, particularly over mobile devices? Because as of now, they aren't making money off of ads on mobile devices. But at the same time, it is, again, the most dominant social network on the internet. And that means that if an advertiser wants to get their message across, that's the company that you want to go to, the website, Facebook, because you're going to have the most bang for your buck, reach the most users globally by approaching Facebook. So yes, there's a lot of excitement, but growth is going to be a big question going forward.
But the very dominance of the company is exactly what raises concerns about the next thing I want to talk to you about, which is the timeline. Tell us how it works and why so many people are so concerned about this.
Sure. You know, the timeline basically is Facebook's way to take all the information that you've given the website, from your photos to the videos you posted to status updates to clicking that little like button saying that you like a particular fan page or like a comment made by a friend or family member, and putting that all into what they would call sort of a scrapbook. The thing is, some users feel like it just, you know, that the company is putting together their information in a way that's a little bit more revealing. Of course, it's not that more people will see it, but it kind of just puts everything out there in a different sort of format that feels a little bit more bearing in some ways. And it's another example of a company, including Google as well, that is taking information in for some users, many users actually, are using their information, using consumer information in a way that users may not want to be used, that they never gave permission in the first place to be used, and they feel sort of out of control. Users are feeling a little out of control with what they've given these websites.
Well, we're speaking with Cecilia Kung, national technology reporter for The Washington Post. We're talking about big news involving media giants Facebook and Google. So obviously we want to talk about what's going on with Google, but just one more question on the Facebook question. What does the company say about that when users are expressing concern about that? What do they say?
Sure. Facebook says, listen, we're not changing your privacy settings, meaning if you said you only want to share your photos with just particular friends, we're not going to change that at all. We're just changing the way it looks. The way that how much is out there on the front page, the photos we put up there. We're making this more of a digital scrapbook than it is sort of a news feed, the way that it's displayed now. All we're doing is changing the look. We're not changing how many people can see it. So, you know, that is definitely something that Facebook has in its defense. That said, sometimes the way things look can feel a little bit more revealing than some people feel comfortable with.
Sure. So let's switch gears now and talk about an issue that really is about privacy, at least as far as the users are concerned. Google says, this is how I understand it. You can tell me if I'm right or wrong.
Sure.
As you wrote in a piece last week, it'll allow the company to stitch together a fuller portrait of users. But some members of Congress are so concerned about this that they've asked to meet with Google CEO Larry Page. So tell us more about this. What's your assessment of this?
Sure. I think the biggest question is why the company decided not to let users say, no, thank you. I'm not so interested in combining my Gmail information with my Picasa information so that you can target ads in a different way toward me. I think that's the biggest question, is that why there isn't an opt out, an option to say, no, thank you, I don't want this to happen. That's what members of Congress are concerned about, and they want to know a little bit more about. They're not necessarily collecting more information. What they're doing, as you just said, is combining data across your services. As long as you're signed in, what they can do is, for example, if you're signed into Gmail, see that, oh, actually, at the same time, you're searching for this on the search engine and watching a particular video clip. So now I know that on YouTube, you like Tony Hawk skateboarding videos. And on the search engine, you have looked for skateboard prices. So now, next time I might recommend a skateboard show in LA or something of that sort. So it's stitching together a more complete picture, as you said, of a person, their likes, their habits, their dislikes.
You know, there's been a lot of division in sort of tech blogging world about this. On the one hand, some people are saying, well, that's just common sense. I mean, that's just the sort of a logical evolution of how this information gets used. Other people are saying, you know what, there's not enough security now. There are still people hacking in finding out, wiping out people's databases, wiping out their personal information, that this just isn't warranted. And again, why can't people opt out? So, Cecilia, I have to ask again, what does the company say about this? Why can't people opt out?
Sure. The company says that it wouldn't be, they wouldn't be able to provide great, tailored, customized services without everybody doing this at once. Why do it halfway? Let's go full force on this. So they say that there isn't an opt-out provision, and they say that this is better for its users. And there is division as to whether this is good or not. So, I mean, behavior ads, I would love it if, in some ways, if somebody could tell me that something's for sale for something that I would actually like to buy, as opposed to something that's not even in on my radar. And so getting my demographic data and, you know, my behavioral, you know, habits, some data on that, in some ways, it's not such a bad idea, some users would say.
Okay.
But others...
I think, I'm sorry, Cecilia, we're out of time, but something tells me we're going to be talking about this again. So please keep us posted. Cecilia Kang is a national technology reporter for The Washington Post. She joined us from the studio at The Washington Post. Cecilia, thank you so much for keeping us up to date.
Thank you.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Alyssa Block.
And I'm Audie Cornish. With all the coverage of Facebook's upcoming IPO, you might be wondering how the company makes so much money. Facebook's revenue depends entirely on its users, how they use the site. And the growth of new users in the U.S. is slowing down. As NPR's Laura Seidel reports, that means Facebook is trying to keep you logged on longer, playing games, watching movies, planning trips, and so on.
So I did a little math with an analyst, and here's what we came up with. If Facebook is valued at $100 billion, and you divide that by 845 million users, that means that each one of us has to be worth $125 apiece. So, where's Facebook going to get that money? It's got to get it from eyeballs on ads. So the strategy for Facebook is to keep people around longer so they look at more ads. Facebook is following Justine Hong, a junior at Duke University, as she walks across campus with her iPhone in her hand.
So I can open the app as I walk to class or whatnot and, you know, see if there's a campus editorial from the campus website that's been getting a lot of comments or a national news story that, you know, my friends have been sharing a lot.
Facebook has apps for games, shopping, video, movies, chat. Last year, it integrated the music service Spotify. That's a feature that has Facebook user Liam Passmore logged on even longer.
One of the elements of Spotify that really attracted me is the ticker on the side of Facebook. You can see what your friends are listening to on Spotify.
Here's an example. It started when Passmore was at the roller rink the other day and a song came on that he liked. Passmore was a little surprised when his friends' 9 and 12-year-old kids told him the name of the singer.
And they said, Selena Gomez. And I screamed, oh no, because, you know, that's Justin Bieber's girlfriend.
However, the 54-year-old thought, I want to share my amusement.
I went to Spotify and played it on my Facebook account to let people know I was listening to Selena Gomez so they could comment back.
Passmore's story would certainly make Facebook executives happy. He's spending more time on the site, and that is exactly what Facebook needs, says Michael Pachter, an analyst at Wedbush who follows the company.
Because ultimately, it's an advertising model, and ultimately, the longer you're on the site, the more information they have about you, the more they can advertise directly to you. So clearly, the more engaged the user, the more profitable that user will be.
Pachter says one strategy the company is starting to use more is to connect with popular websites. So when you sign on to your favorite newspaper site or game site, you can do it with your Facebook sign-in, says Justin Smith, founder of Inside Network, which is dedicated to researching Facebook.
Facebook's strategy will be to increase penetration amongst many of the most popular websites, you know, where people are spending their time, instead of only being available when people come to Facebook.com.
A lot of people think it would make more sense for Facebook to build its own phone or develop its own mobile operating system. The caveat for Facebook's strategy of becoming a portal to everything on the internet is that many users, like Duke student Hong, aren't signing up.
because I think it gets to be a little bit scary when you're sharing a lot of information via your Facebook account.
But with new pressures from Wall Street for growth, Facebook is certainly going to try hard to lure Hong and other users deeper into its universe. Laura Seidel, NPR News.
The Super Bowl isn't just the biggest thing in football, it's the single most watched TV broadcast of the year. And that makes it the biggest ad delivery vehicle of the year, too. We all know people who say they just watch the Super Bowl for the ads, but Eric Deggans of the Tampa Bay Times watches the football and the ads. Eric, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So, Eric, it seems like you don't even have to watch the game to see the ads anymore, right? I mean, they're all online already. We actually put together a little kind of montage of the greatest hits.
Roderick. Roderick.
You have excellent taste in automobiles.
You have one Pepsi Max for life!
See a lot more now at GoDaddy.co.
This is the reinvented Toyota Camry, available with everything you could possibly want.
Eric, were those dogs barking the Star Wars theme?
Exactly. Yeah, it might be the seventh circle of hell for some people, I guess. But what that really was a trailer for an ad, a different ad that's going to run during the big game featuring a dog chasing after a Volkswagen. And this is part of the big trend now. We get trailers for ads, and then we get the ad released several days before the actual big game, and then we see the ad again when the game airs.
So they're really milking it.
Well, the idea
every dime
is
out of the millions they spend for that ad.
The idea is to build buzz. And one of the things we saw, the first clip was of Ferris Bueller, Matthew Broderick recreating a character that seems like his character from Ferris Bueller's Day Off. They put out a teaser where you saw that the current Matthew Broderick was reacting in a scene, recreating a scene from Ferris Bueller, but you didn't know who the advertiser was. And I thought we wouldn't find out until the actual game. But it turns out on Monday, they revealed the full ad, and everyone has it on their Facebook pages and their blogs, and they're talking about it online. So by the time the game actually airs, there's already a lot of people who are already buzzing about it.
So, Eric, what does this mean in terms of mobile technology? I mean, are we seeing companies move some of the ads there as well?
Yes, we're seeing a lot of ads that reach out to the mobile space. Coca-Cola is doing something interesting where they're having the polar bears, there's CGI, computer-generated polar bears, star in a couple of ads, and you can surf to a site that will also allow you to watch the polar bears react in real time to what's happening in the game. And each polar bear is wearing a little muffler that kind of is in the colors of each team that's playing. So depending on who's doing well and who's not, they react differently. Why someone would want to watch polar bears instead of an actual football game,
right?
I'm not sure.
Well, the bears are talking. I mean, you got me there. No, normally I would totally make fun of this and anyone who does it. However, I found that more and more I have a device open during events of all kinds, whether it's debates or, you know, something on TV. And I am following what people are saying on Twitter and the social networking. So it seems like there's sort of two screens happening.
Yes. What I have said in a story that I've written for the Tampa Bay Times is that the war is no longer for the first screen. The war is for the second screen. Now, what I worry about some of these social media applications that they've developed is that it's not really enabling you to talk to other people or connect with other friends. It's more about intersecting with this brand. I don't necessarily care what the polar bears think about the Super Bowl. I'm more interested in what my friend in Baltimore or what my friend in San Francisco thinks about the game. You figure out a way to connect me to that person in a way that's compelling, and that's when we'll really have the Super Bowl of social media.
Thanks so much, Eric.
Thank you.
Eric Deggans of the Tampa Bay Times.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
And when Facebook filed to go public this week, analysts wondered whether it was really worth the $100 billion it's valued at. But there's no question about one thing. Many employees are about to become very, very rich. Steve Henn reports.
There's this guy named David Cho.
I love spray painting. I can't get enough of it.
Back in the day, Facebook hired him to paint graffiti murals all over the company's original office space in Palo Alto. Even Mark Zuckerberg got into the act.
I'm going to make a tiny stick figure.
Cho was paid for his work in stock. And according to the New York Times, that stock could soon be worth $200 million. One of the guilty pleasures of an IPO filing is getting to peer inside a company as famous as Facebook and get a glimpse of who owns what. Of course, there's Mark Zuckerberg.
Obviously, should be worth a tidy $25 billion.
Henry Blodgett is the editor of the Business Insider and was the bad boy analyst of the last internet boom. This time, the bad boys are becoming billionaires, like
Sean Parker.
Parker was Facebook's first president, and before that, he co-founded Napster.
The man who, in the movie at least, famously said, "A million isn't cool, a billion is cool," and he will have several of them.
In that movie, The Social Network, Dustin Moskovitz had little more than a cameo. He was Zuckerberg's college roommate, but he could soon be worth $7 billion.
I mean, if he had been down the hall, we wouldn't be talking about him.
Michael Stern runs a website called Who Owns Facebook? He says Moskovitz wasn't the only winner of the roommate lottery. Zuckerberg's prep school roommate will walk away with a couple $100 million himself.
A lot of people won the lottery here.
And Blodgett says not all of these future billionaires are boys.
Sheryl Sandberg could be.
She's Facebook's COO. And after her options vest,
she's going to be one of the richest self-made women ever.
According to its filings, Facebook has close to 1,100 stockholders. Many more could benefit from restricted stock options. But Robert Frank, who writes the wealth blog at the Wall Street Journal and is the author of the new book, The High Beta Rich, says this doesn't mean all these folks will become instant millionaires.
More than half of this company is owned by just five large shareholders. So, like most of America, wealth in Facebook is very top-heavy, concentrated among just a few people at the top.
In Silicon Valley, it's become gospel to assume Facebook's IPO will create 1,000 new millionaires. And while that may be true, Frank says, really, it's impossible to know for sure.
Even those with a lot of shares will see their wealth fluctuate wildly. So the number of millionaires may change.
After all, this is a tech stock. And Frank says all this wealth is just on paper, at least for now. Steve Henn, NPR News, Silicon Valley.
You're listening to Morning Edition from NPR News.